I would make steps forward, but I was constantly getting pulled back and by my own. And I was just like, I'm gonna fucking go for it. I'm gonna become something else. I'm gonna like destroy myself and become the thing that I want to be.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidi.
This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidi is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Lea Davidi, who passed away earlier this year. Here I am with Savta Lea in mind.
My guest today is, this is an exciting one, I have to tell you. My guest today is a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter. You probably don't know him as Matthew Paul Miller, but rather by his stage name, Matis Yahu. So just really excited to say, here I am with Matis Yahu.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you doing, man? Thank you so much for taking the drive here.
Absolutely.
Yes, this is great. I'm looking forward to talking about a lot of things, but the first question that I ask everyone, I feel like is going to be an interesting one here. But to see how, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, right. I am, I don't know, Judaism has been in my life for most of my life, since at least, you know, since I was 16 that I remember it being like kind of an important thing. But I went to Hebrew school as a kid and stuff, you know. I grew up Reconstructionist, and then I started exploring Kalbach and Chabad, and ended up pretty in Crown Heights in Lubavitch in yeshiva there. So that became kind of the main route from where my Orthodox Judaism stems from, and then. From there, I started learning more Breslov Hasidus and davening by the Karliner Hasidim and Toldos Aron and different places. So I started exploring different things. And from there, I found myself internalizing a lot of the ideas and stuff and what I was learning in yeshiva and what I was practicing. But I found a lot of those just... like they say in Chabad, like das, like when the knowledge starts to come down in an experiential and emotional kind of connection to things. And so at that point, I kind of just decided that the religion was kind of like the outer garment of things. And I kind of was tapped into the real thing on the inside. So that was when I literally like shaved and sort of changed, you know, gradually kind of started to let go of things. And then from there, I kind of just like wanted to just give God a break for a little bit. And just I felt I had like focused so much of my energy in my 20s and 30s and into God and stuff. So I started to come back, and all this is reflected in the albums. Like the album, first album, Shake Off the Dust Arise, is all Chabad, like Tanya references and stuff like that. And then Akeda was the time of me, you know, kind of coming into ownership of like a lot of these ideas and really stepping out and stepping into the freedom of making my own choices again and stuff. And then Undercurrent, and it's like the return of, like you said, Matthew Miller, of who is Matthew Miller, and kind of give God a break. I felt like God wanted a break, and I wanted a break from God, like, and that was okay, that's part of any healthy relationship even. So then I just kind of got into just being human, just being me, a dad, a husband, an artist, musician, you know, hockey dad life, that kind of thing, you know. and still inspired at times, you know. Take the dogs for a walk, smoke a joint, think of some Hasidus and some philosophy or something, and like get off on it, and then come back inside and put the kids to sleep, you know, that kind of more spirituality in that way. And then October 7th happened, and that's a paradigm shift. Everything changes from that point on. I think that we're entering into a new time, in the world. And just like right after 9/11 was when I became really religious, it was like a reverberation. There was some kind of like balance thing. And same thing here. I felt myself, without even question, being pulled back into wanting to express and own my Jewish identity. And the religious aspect of that becomes after October 7th so minor. Now me, because I spend some time, so I have to fill in and I can put it on, you know, and I know certain things. But the majority of Jews in America that come from mainly Reform backgrounds and stuff have no idea even how to connect to their Judaism if they want to. But there becomes this sort of split between people who either want to become connected or want to connect and or who don't. And the religious thing of if you call yourself Reform or Orthodox, it all kind of crumbling away. And that is maybe one of the only good things to have come from all of this, is like the squeezing of the Jews and the needing for some Jews are going to run away, but the ones that are there are going to start to shine their light and like step forth into their roles as Jews, as leaders, as we become chosen.
Wow, we do. We become chosen. I love that. And the way you describe it reminds me a lot of how, obviously, you're a musician. Like when someone watches a show and the musician keeps changing guitars and every guitar looks a little bit different and sounds a little bit different, but we're all a vessel for the same thing, which is music. And for you, you kind of had different entrances and guitars to different aspects of the same thing, which is your Jewish identity. Do you mind if we break down that journey for you a little bit? Because sure. I think a lot of people would love to hear. You started off as you were raised Reconstructionist. A lot of people don't know what is that. What's the
Reconstructionist is kind of, it can mean a lot of different levels of religiosity, but the main focus is it's egalitarian. So like what it looks like is the women are going to be wearing talluses and yarmulkes. Most people are not putting on tefillin. There are some families that may have come from religious backgrounds. Maybe they put on tefillin, but it's more about social justice and doing social work, you know, tikkun olam, that kind of stuff, and egalitarian thing. So that's the kind of synagogue that I grew up in. And
when you were a kid, were you leaning into that, or were you more?
I was extremely rebellious. Yeah. That place, even though it was filled with nice people, there was something about the whole thing that just really rubbed me the wrong way. And I spent much of my time in the principal's office, frustrated, literally having crying after class, like, don't send me back there. But somehow, the rabbi was extremely, extremely nice guy, really nice guy. And I had my bar mitzvah there. I was the final bar mitzvah of throwing candy, because I had a lot of friends that snuck in like hard candy and people got pegged in the face and it was bad. Not as bad as my cousin Adam, who ripped the Torah with the pointer and then hocked a loogie into it to try to seal it up before the rabbi could see. But no, I was not into it really. But then I did stay on after Hebrew school for the Monday night class, you know, the pizza class or whatever. Uh-huh. So, and then there I found out about this program, conservative program, Alexander Muss High School in Israel, to go to Israel for 4 months or something like that.
Right, which is still ongoing for many kids.
Yeah,
but still
they reach out to me all the time. I see them, they come to shows sometimes. They'll have like posters like, I went to Alexander Moss.
Was that your first time visiting Israel?
Yeah, so I was 16. And my parents are like, you know, not extremely religious, but they wanted to move to Israel. They moved to Israel to make Aliyah prior to my being born. And they ended up, they weren't together, they were just like friends. They ended up like together in Israel, and then they wanted to come back. I think they wanted to come back for whatever reason. They felt, I think they weren't like really making friends or something like that. This was like in the 70s.
Right.
And then they to get back, they had to sell their record collection. So when they went to sell all the records, they started meeting people and they started making friends. They didn't want to move back. That's the famous story of that, whatever.
I think that's basically the experience of being a Jew and Israeli. It's like you want to be there, you don't want to be there. Yeah, you keep going back and forth and you're like you're
interesting.
Uncomfortable everywhere.
Yeah. So anyway, so.
So you went to Alexander Mus. And
I went there, yeah, when I was 16.
What was that like?
That was just a trip. It was like I got grounded on the very beginning of the trip. A kid got real drunk who we were out with, and we somehow convinced the staff that we weren't drinking, that he was the only one drinking. And we were interrogated Israeli style by like the entire like staff. I remember it. I'd never experienced anything like that before. And someone vouched for me, the RA, and she's from Miami. I see her from time to time at shows, you know. She was like, no, I smelled his breath when he came in. He wasn't drinking. So they didn't send me home. Thank God. Can you imagine? I would have had like a bad taste in my mouth for Israel. I may have never become Modest Yahoo. I would have just like been like, so I stayed, but I couldn't leave the campus for like 3 weeks or something.
All right.
And I just rollerbladed all over the campus and ate falafel in a skirt with dreadlocks. That was like I would like wear a skirt and I had dreadlocks and I was smoking weed already. And so I think we found weed there. I started smoking cigarettes a pack a day. No. I think by then it was like time cigarettes. I remember the horrible taste and the horrible feeling of smoking as a 16-year-old. Like when you first start smoking cigarettes, it's like the worst fucking thing.
Time cigarette is also very Israeli. It's in the 80s and 90s, by the way.
Yeah. So, and sex, you know, like there was a bunch of girls from various campuses and there was like a lot of crazy shit going on. And then actually enjoying the learning aspect for the first time in my life, because it was like, you know, this was interesting to me, the history of the Jewish people and seeing it and all of that.
What changed? You think the learning changed? What?
Yeah, it was obviously a different style of learning than being in a classroom. You know, it was like you're out there, you know, it was an experiential learning program. Right. So, and I had ended up having just an incredible experience. And I think I felt like really that moment when you go to Jerusalem to Mount Scopus during sunset and, you know, where they design that moment, you know, for you as a young Jew. They do it on Birthright and all these trips and stuff like that. It really works. It really works. I remember just that intense feeling of how powerful and rich my heritage and feeling Jewish was.
But that's interesting. So do you remember the first time, probably on that trip, that you went to the Western Wall?
Yeah. I remember, you know, not, actually, because it was like a parade. I don't remember what holiday it was. Whatever holiday where they have a parade of people like walking down to the Kotel. That must be various holidays.
Various holidays.
It could have been Jerusalem Day. Yeah. It could have been. It was like during Tishrei time.
Did you feel anything? Because you grew up a constructionist, kind of God optional. At that moment, did you feel something did that come later?
That summer, I had gone to Colorado on like a wilderness trip, like an Outward Bound type thing. And I had really felt this initial experience that I felt was what I was calling it God.
Was it substance?
No, not at all. I mean, it was like we were in a sweat lodge, you know, really hot sweat lodge, Native American, you know, in the woods.
Yeah.
You know, it's hot. And then you come out and you jump into like a mountain creek, look up at the stars and it's like, and you're like, you know, whoa, you know, this cosmic feeling, you know? And then this immense feeling, what I started to feel was loneliness, you know, on those mountains, like looking up at the mountains, you know, at the vastness of the world and the beauty of it all. Somehow for me, that all felt there was like this intense sadness that came along with that feeling, with feeling that. And just, I guess that was a feeling of being like an adult in the world or something. Right. Yeah, you know, going from being a kid into being like a real being in the world, and the feeling of like the aloneness of that. And like, where immediately God was born for me in that moment. You know, like, oh, there's something. There's like someone, something that's here with me.
So your next stop was Karlbach. Well, how'd you find yourself?
In terms of Judaism?
Yeah.
From Israel. So that was 16. And then I didn't start going to the Karlbach shul till I was about like 20 or something like that. So, you know, I ended up dropping out of high school and going to follow the band Fish around the country, like, you know, hitchhiking around the country with a bag of quarters. And I did that for a while and then was in rehab and then was in a wilderness treatment program and then ended up in Bend, Oregon, started doing music and acting. I played the role of the boy in Equus at like a theater in Bend, Oregon, and started my first band and started playing shows.
What were you guys called?
Soul for I.
Soul for I?
Yeah, we had two. And then we had like a duo also called The Mystical Truth. There's video footage. Actually, I'm not going to tell you because I'm not, you know, but it is.
No, you can tell. If there's a place to say, it's right here. Yeah, no one's watching or listening, you and I.
So, you know, there was a coffee shop in this town at the time was smallish. Now it's not so small, Bend, Oregon. And they had open mic night and I, you know, would met a guitar player and I would freestyle and rap and he would play and we would do our thing there. And then they gave us our own night. And then this is on footage. There's footage of this, of me coming in wrapped in an Israeli flag and like raps, all kinds of raps with sage burning. And we had drunk like mushroom tea. We were like tripping our balls off. And I like call out into the crowd. I'm like, who's Jewish?
In Bend, Oregon.
And like two people like raise their hand. And I'm like, hold this. And I make them hold the Israeli flag the entire performance of this just random like jamming or whatever. So it was always sort of like before I was Modest Yahoo, somehow that trip to Israel inspired me from even my early writing, like my first raps and my first lyrics had a lot of like imagery from stuff that I had seen and started to think about in terms of what it means to be a Jew and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, Karlbach was where I landed at first when I was in college. And what happened in college?
What drew you to Karlbach?
I was trying, there were multiple times in my life where I was going in and out of addiction with different things. But at that time, I was like, I really wanted to do music. I knew that it was like against all the odds. Like how is that possible? I knew that I was talented and I had been like developing my talent in my room, like, you know, without an audience there.
Yeah.
Just working on it and like living in that, like the music I was listening to and the lyrics I was writing and the space that I was in, you know, just developing that for a year or two in college. And yeah, again, this lonely feeling, this intense feeling of loneliness, you know, and sadness, you know, you can call it, you know, depression maybe. I don't know. I never got it analyzed or anything like that, but it could be anxiety, depression. I don't know. But, you know, this sort of longing feeling and also longing to rise above it and to be something like greater than my limitations. Like I had tapped into a certain like greatness in myself that I knew was possible. And I was drowning and I just couldn't figure out how I would make steps forward, but I was constantly getting pulled back and by my own inabilities and stuff. And I was just like, I'm gonna fucking go for it. I'm gonna become something else. I'm gonna like destroy myself and become the thing that I want to be. And I was like, I started praying for that to become, you know. And so that was just all on my own. I just found a prayer book that I had gotten and a prayer shawl from my grandfather. And I started going up onto the roof of the new school. That's how I went to the new school. I went to Eugene Lang College. And I would go up there to smoke blunts and stuff. But I was at that point when I was trying to, so I stopped smoking weed at that point, you know, and I was And I was going up there and I would pray for that, you know. And I would pray in Hebrew, even though I didn't understand it. You know, I knew how to read Hebrew from Reconstructionist Hebrew School. Taught me that at least.
You were probably the only kid in Eugene Lang
who's ever davened on the roof of Eugene Lang prayed. On 12th Street.
I mean, I used to teach at the New School. I used to teach at Eugene Lang, and religion is not a big thing.
No, it was an interesting time for me, which is interesting because at that same time period, when all that was going on, I took a class from a guy named Gary Lemons. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know him. I think he was let go, like, you know, he was very controversial, very intense. He taught black studies courses and stuff, and it was mostly white kids signing up that wanted to learn what the black experience was. And he would flip it on us and tell us, what is the white experience, you know? And he would kind of, he was trying to get us to, you know, realize what our whiteness is and this, that, and the other thing. And so the question of identity became very much like at the core. It always was sort of at the core of who I am, and but it became like in the focus, in the limelight, because I was inspired by this teacher and he was teaching us great stuff. I felt there was like love, real love behind it, but it was intense. Like a lot of teachers I've had voice teachers that were on the verge of violent, you know, and crazy, but also I've had spiritual teachers that way, you know. I've often found myself attracted to people on the verge of some kind of, in terms of what, when I want to learn from someone.
Yeah. And basically also what we're pushing you to your limit, which requires.
For sure. But you know, I think anytime if you're actively like growing and trying to learn in various, you know, areas, you're going to come up with different types of teachers. You're going to find different types of teachers that will give you different things. And sometimes you're going to find those kind of intense, so crazy.
Who was your next big teacher? I think you...
So
you ended up living with him for a while.
Yeah, so from where... I didn't even get to how I got to Karlbach.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, wow.
No, it's
wow,
crazy,
wow.
But... I'm trying to remember. My mind sometimes. I was talking about the New School and going up to the New School to pray, right? So I found one day there was a Jewish club there at the New School. They had a Jewish club. I don't know if they still do.
I don't know either, but I hope they do.
They damn well should. But that's how I met my first manager, because the Bronfman Center at NYU was for the New School also. So there was a Chabad rabbi giving a class in Chassidus there. And I met a couple other musicians that were at NYU at Music Business School. Mm. And that became like my first management group that ended up helping me. But I really was interested. I was kind of fascinated like in Chassidim. And I was like, I would see him and I would be like, this man is going to teach me something. And so I would be like, teach me something. And he would be like, here, this is tefillin. Go to this hospital, go to this room and put it on this kid. He fell down the stairs, this Russian kid. And then I would go do it, and he'd be like, no, every day. And I was like, okay, there was some Karate Kid type shit, like paint the fence.
Every day.
I wanted to learn like Kabbalah and shit. I wanted to like learn how to pray, how to tap in and meditate and, you know, do all. And they had me, before I was even putting tefillin on myself, I was putting tefillin on a kid in the hospital on the Lower East Side. And I was going every day in between classes to put tefillin on him, which is very Chabad. It's like do a mitzvah, you know.
Right, he's like, teaching you gemilut chasadim, like he's teaching you like to do before you
coming down out of the clouds. And my tendency was always to like be reaching for there, and the times where I found like the most, I guess, spiritual contentment was in dealing with real stuff, you know, like, you know, even like in the wilderness and stuff like that. You know,
so you met this Chabad Hasidic rabbi.
Yeah, his name was Rabbi Cohen, Eli Cohen. And then I ended up trying a lot of different things, but this is just fun, you know. I mean, there was these brothers I met. They had a band called Pay Dalad. These three brothers, they were like completely dysfunctional. But they made like great music. Like there was times like their voices would all lock in and they would lock in. But like getting to the gig was a nightmare. And they were Orthodox, and I wanted to pray in an Orthodox synagogue. So I went in there and I saw these guys in there. I started like playing with them. So I started like getting introduced to the Orthodox world a little bit. It was very weird to me. And
what did it feel like for you? Like you grew up in a Reconstructionist synagogue community where it's all egalitarian and Orthodox, at least at first, before you delve into the details, can feel like the opposite.
I think I also, one of my like demons or one of the things that I was dealing with was my like sex and stuff like that, you know? So for me, I was like ready to go more monk style. And like, I appreciated the separation. I kind of I was interested in that, you know, to some extent. Like I wanted to separate from anything that could be a distraction from what I was like going for. And so then anyway, I tried different things, but you know, I would always like look for what is the thing I'm looking for? Like something authentic. And then I went into the Karl Barth shul and I was just like, this is it. This is the spot. So
what was about it?
Oh my God, the music. Like I never heard Jewish music like this. The melodies, like my whole entire life, I had never heard a Karl Barth melody. Like if you grew up Reformed, you know, or something, you might not never hear it. A Karl Barth melody. I was on my search. So I went to B'nai Jeshuan where they're playing like violins and shit. I went all kinds of places. And I've always had a huge distaste for like group singing. Like I hate like the melody and everyone's like singing the melody together. It's always been like so annoying to me and not musical. And so... I don't know, but like for the very first time I walked into a synagogue and they were like singing and there's this like young kid beating on the bima, like drum beats, like hip hop kind of drum beats. And he's fucking good. And the women are jamming out on their side and the men are dancing. They all look like hippies. I'm like, this is the fucking place. Like this, like I was like, this is the shit. So I would like run there for Shabbos. And I was very antisocial kind of and a little weird. So I was just kind of like, I wouldn't really meet anyone. I wouldn't really talk to anyone or go home to anyone for lunch or anything. But I would just go there and I would just like, that was my first thing I was into. And I started.
Remember any of the tunes?
Yeah, all of them, of course. Like all the normal Friday night davening.
So a lot of people listening in have never heard a Karl Barth tune. So like what would be a...
You know,
a good intro
you know,
for them.
I don't know if they know. They either know or they don't know, I think. No, I don't know. But basically, you know, I was into it. So then I started just reading all the books about Shlomo Karl Barth. And I got onto that, like, Shlomo Karl Barth drug, you know, like, oh, take some of that, please. You know, like all the miracles and reading all the shit that he talks about and that whole style. And I got on that, like, woo, you know, like the God, like, and I start wearing a yarmulke. Now I'm representing myself as a Jew to the rest of the world. I'm seeing the reaction, the whole identity crisis thing that was happening for me in college with all, you know, it kind of like filled a lot. I was like, yes, you know, I'm like disciplined now. And I'm, you know, so I just got into it. And then I met Korn, Rabbi Korn at NYU. You know, the story is kind of cool. Like I was wearing the yarmulke and the tzitzis and I was hanging out with some friends at Smalls, the jazz, it's like a famous jazz club in the city. And everyone smoked cigarettes in there. And I had some drinks at the bar and smoked some weed. And I started like passing out and I started to like to go up the stairs to get out. And I like collapse at the top. And when I wake up, like someone's throwing water on my hands and it's like a Jew, like an EMT with a yarmulke. And he looks at me and he's like, this is a kid, a Chilo Hashem, you know? And I'm like, oh shit. Like, it's not just Matt Miller anymore. Like I'm representing myself as something. And then I was really bummed out about it. And I was in Washington Square Park. I think I like took a nap. And I like woke up. And I see this little Orthodox like girl, blonde hair, and I like all everything comes into focus around her, and it's Rabbi Korn, a young Rabbi Korn from NYU. He's like maybe 20 years old. He's got two kids already, two little kids and his Hasidic wife, and a sukkah. And I like walk into the sukkah, and that was it. From that point on, I was like by his side for the next like 6 months to a year. I lived at his apartment. I like, you know, made breakfast for his family. I studied Hasidus. We said the whole book of Tehillim together on Shabbos Mevarkim and walked to the mikveh together. And I was constipated from the food for months. I was, you know, it was like, that real initial, like coming into being religious, like past the fun. But he had a way of making it very fun. For me, it was like this huge, existential question. Like, do I buy this? Am I going to believe this? Am I going to live my whole life and dedicate all this time and energy to, I'm not going to do that if I don't get it, you know? So that until you make the decision and really go for it, then it's very like hard space to live in when you're in between. And he was just like, made that shit fun.
Interesting, because it's also, it works the other way around. People that are very orthodox and men.
Sure.
They leave the orthodoxy or whatever religious we're in until you make that jump. It's very hard to live in that middle point.
Yep. I've done both.
So when did you take the plunge and, you know, black hat, black jacket?
So then once I was living with him, you know, that was like from one of our like field days, was like, we go to the van at Crown Heights and pick out Hasidic clothing. And that was it, you know?
Do you remember the first time you saw yourself looking in the mirror and instead of you, Matt, you see?
I remember Simchas Torah. I had started like at the Karl Barth Shul. I had walked. It was like my first religious. I was still like on my own religious, and I had walked down to Rabbi Korn and Rabbi Benkholter had a place on Union Square, and we were dancing with the Torah and they were drinking vodka, and I was like super drunk, and I had already started growing the beard, and I was doing some little acting and commercials. And I got offered a Miller Lite commercial, but I had to shave the beard. And I had asked one Orthodox rabbi who was like, shave it. And then I had asked Rabbi Korn, he was like, don't shave it. And I remember like sort of drunk, jolly, like happy as I could be, just looking in the mirror and with the beard and being like, all right, Matt, like, this is it. Like, you're going to do this now. Like, this is what you're going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And that night, like walking back to Crown Heights, sleeping in some random chassid's like house in their basement, and like learning about like Neglevasser, like I can't leave my bed like until I wash my hands. I'd be like, I'm in this fucking crazy place, you know. And then the next day, going to 770 to hear the Nagunim by like all of the entire community.
For people listening, 770 is basically the headquarters of Chabad in Crown Heights.
Yeah. And like bleachers are out, and everyone's there singing these like intense, like Russian, like Nagunim, like the really powerful songs. And I remember feeling like just swept up in it, just like here, take my soul. Like, yes, I will do this now. Like the Rebbe just grabbing me, just like. Mm-hmm. Because that feeling of that longing and that, you know, it just really tapped into that. So I stayed.
And you stayed for a while.
For like 2 years, yeah. I like in yeshiva before I like left. Before I started doing like any music or anything.
Right. And so let's get to that. You're at this point, you're a Lubavitcher Chabadnik. You live in Crown Heights and you start making music. Start again, I guess. You go back to making music. I think the first question that comes up is, when do you become Matisyahu?
That was like probably Rabbi Korn, I think. Probably I got, you know, Matthew is the name. So that was my English name. So Matityahu. But the Ashkenazi pronunciation is Matisyahu.
But why not Matthew?
Because you go to yeshiva, you take on, you don't go with the name of a Christian disciple. Certainly not two. Uh-huh. You take on the Jewish name. You know, they always tell you like the bit, like, you know, in Egypt, they were slaves, but they still had their Jewish names. Uh-huh. You
So you became Matisyahu to your friends, to everyone around?
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Like, I became a new thing. Like, it wasn't just the, you know, it was everything. Like, I stopped listening to music. Forget doing music. I stopped listening to music. Any kind of, like, pop culture, movies, TV, anything like that. No talking to girls, taking my glasses off when I walk down the street. A hat and suit and jacket when it's 102 degrees in New York City in July. You know, the praying, like saying the whole thing, you know, the whole thing. I was fully in mikveh every day. Not just kosher or glad kosher, Chabad kosher, you know, like I went full on, like all the mishigas, you know, cause I took on all of Rabbi Korn's crap at that time, you know, which was where he was at, you know, at that time. Cause he was still a young chassid, even though he was, you know, a rabbi for people. So, yeah, so I took it all on. I studied in the yeshiva, and I was given on Fridays was like the one day to leave yeshiva and like go back into this like other world that was like this. It was like the Twilight Zone, right? Because it was like I was there, you know, but now I'm coming back, like, and I feel different. I feel like a different person, but it was so weird. But Friday afternoons was like I was given a route in Chelsea to go like around and like give Shabbos candles to this lady who had like a heart store, Wendy. And there was like a guy who worked at Barnes and Nobles, and there was like, you know, Jews that they had found, that the Shluchim had found or whatever. And I would go put tefillin on people and stuff, you know. And it was actually exhilarating leaving and going there and like, you know, putting tefillin on a Jew who had never put on tefillin, and the feeling of like, wow, I'm somehow like, saved his soul or something, you know.
Have you ever had in those moments encountered with people who knew you before the beer?
It's incredible. On Rosh Hashanah, so like some of these times was long walks like to all the ends of Brooklyn and stuff to blow the shofar for like other Jews who already heard the shofar. They'd be like, why the hell are you here? Excuse me. But on Rosh Hashanah, after having done that, I'm in Williamsburg and I bump into Aaron Dugan, who played guitar in one of the bands that I used to sit in with at the New School. At the New School, I had met a bunch of musicians. And so I would often try to sit in with them, with their bands. And he was one of the musicians I had met. And so I saw him and I asked if his mother was Jewish. And I blew the shofar, I think, for him. And I told him that I had gotten a gig and could I hire him to play? And it was for Hanukkah for Rabbi Korn in Union Square. And that was like the first time somehow like a camera saw me like perform. Cause I did it. I just grabbed, there was like this homeless keyboard player outside 770. And there was like this chassid who I knew played the drums, and I grabbed the two of them and like my PA system. We got on the 3 train and we like got to Union Square and set up, and I'm like beatboxing. Rabbi Korn's like, dude, do the thing. I'm like beatboxing, and it's loud and it's like reverberating off all the buildings, and I've got my eyes closed. And when I open my eyes, there's like hundreds and hundreds of people there and a news camera on me that I was there for some other reason, but. And from that, like CNN saw that news footage and then asked to interview me. And I did this interview on CNN where I like sang and beatboxed. And then like the Steve Harvey show saw that. And then the Jimmy Kimmel show saw the Steve Harvey show, you know, and it was like a series of things that on that side, like on the, it was like one of the first viral videos was like that Jimmy Kimmel clip was, but all that time was like very into Chabad. And when I eventually, the point is with that route, I ended up like convincing my rabbi that I would have more influence over a greater number of people if he would let me give that route to somebody else and let me go record music in the studio.
Good call.
Yeah. And he was cool. He was like, yeah, okay. They had heard me because I got really drunk one night and jumped up on the table in the Catskills and did my shtick. And like they encouraged me to do it.
What was your shtick? Like, you know,
like we'd all be singing the Nagunim and then I would like really like punch it. And then like I would get up and do like the reggae thing. You know, I would do like the reggae chanting thing that I do. and maybe beatboxing or something. And I did it, like there was someone that knew me from like Rabbi Korn's and who knew that I did it. So they encouraged me to. And the rabbis loved it. Like from the get-go, they were like, this fucking kid has something.
I mean, isn't that the whole
point?
They
didn't want me to leave. Like the Rosh Yeshiva was like, he's not ready. And he knew I was, according to those, like that I would probably... But
that's the whole point, right? The Hasidic whole point is like you don't just like study Judaism, you experience it. It's the whole experiential music with all your body. Like that's, you embodied that for them.
And we would go to the Catskills and we would learn Hasidus under the gazebo and mikveh in the little lake there in the river. And, you know, it was kind of like cool, you know, be with all the rabbis and their families. We all be up there together. It felt like some kind of rehab because we were all the Baal Tshuvas that were there. We had been through some crazy shit because you don't choose to do that unless you've either got some kind of issues that you're working through. Like there's no one that's choosing to go do that, you know? Like you're choosing it, but it's like choosing to go to the military, not in Israel, but another, you know, in Israel it's different, or choosing like, you know, the path of becoming like a monk or a priest or something like.
It chooses
something,
you.
Something had to happen in your life that like pushing you to like want to reject the world. You know what I mean? So anyway, it felt very healthy though in the sense that like we were all just kind of like, I knew a lot of people had been on, we were drinking and stuff. There was drinking, but it wasn't like, it was Shabbos mostly. But I felt like a lot of people had been on drugs or had been through abuse in some way and we were all kind of just like mellowing out and like purifying in some way. And it was like a purification is what it was like.
So at what point did you become that guy, that Hasidic guy who's also like, you know, known for his music and people being surprised, finding out he's Hasidic, you know, hearing your songs and then seeing your videos, like, whoa, that breaks the stereotype. When was that for you?
Well, I remember because I took my family out to dinner and I paid for it. And I have a picture. I look so fucking happy, like with next to my dad, like I fucking made some money doing this. I can't believe it. When it was happening, it was unbelievable that it was happening. Because I did the thing. And now it was like, I was being rewarded and it was actually happening. Yeah. You know, I had like an ego death. I realized at some point in yeshiva that if I like continue to hold on to my dream of being in a musician or a rapper or reggae music, that I was like not going to be able to accomplish the true goal of why I was there in the first place. Mm-hmm. That was going to be like my golden idol, you know, that I was going to like keep on the shelf. Like when you're in yeshiva, you keep finding like, what's that next thing that you're holding on to? And then you like destroy it. And then you're like, okay, I'm good. And then you're like, no, there's something else back there that you're holding on to. And it's like, oh, this dream of Modest Yahoo or whatever. And like, I had to like, at some point, just be like, nah, that's not going to happen. And when that happened, then I got this call from these two guys from the Bronfman Center at NYU. And like, we graduated, we got a grant, we got some money, and we are starting a record label and we want you to be the first artist. And I was like, I'll take a meeting.
you already knew how the industry works. I'll take a meeting.
I got on the train. I sat there with them, you know. I played, I don't know. I just said like, okay, well, what does that even mean? Like they didn't have distribution. There was no nothing. They're like, well, let us just book some shows or whatever. So I said, talk to the rabbis, blah, blah, blah. They're like, okay, if you get married, you got to get married if you're going to do that. All right.
So why did they want to get married?
They felt that I would probably fry out much quicker. Like if I wasn't married, which is probably true. So I got married and they started booking me shows. I started playing the shows and they went really well, like immediately. Like I played like a couple shows opening up for people. And then like, it was like, I think when some things are successful, it's like, there's like a lack. There's like people want something and there's nothing filling that hole. And like, if you were Jewish and you wanted to somehow connect to something Jewish, but not necessarily religious, but you didn't want to go to like the JCC, but you wanted to go to like Irving Plaza or the Mercury Lounge. And then I just like stepped in with this like weird bread of like music that people could connect to, and like the whole thing. So it just like there was like people at the shows.
So was your audience originally mostly Jews?
I would say originally it was mostly like probably like Reform Jews, like working Jews in New York City, like young professionals or whatever. And
how would they react? You'd see you come on stage.
I was so like on fire because I've been in a fucking basement in Yeshiva for 2 years and like gone through this whole thing. And like now it was, I was like, okay, like I was being like, I was being like allowed to do it, and it was like successful. And so it was like, it was an amazing feeling. And also I felt like I had to like prove like something to the world, like something serious. So I get on stage and I would like, I was so hungry that like this, it was electric. And the shows were like super electric like that. Like the A&R saw me at like Ramaz High School for like a Rosh Chodesh at like 8 a.m. and signed me, like, immediately offered me a deal because...
Wait. Stop that for a second. You know, so A&R is Artists and Represents, right?
Yeah.
What are we doing in Ramaz at 8 a.m. on Rosh Chodesh? You know, that's not a place A&R typically hang out.
No. I was also on the Carson Daly show, like, that same day. But not... Like, Carson had a music show at that point. And so I was on that show. They had done a bit. And I also... was on tour and we were playing, we were playing a gig, like, you know, we would take some Jewish gigs like whenever we could, you know, to try to, you know, so yeah, that was one. It was like 8 a.m. I had a 15 passenger van. It was like me and these new school music school guys that weren't Jewish, that, well, you know, certainly weren't religious, you know, one of them was Jewish, two of them was Jewish, not Jewish, Jewish, whatever, you know, but they like, they were just normal dudes, and we were like traveling around the country. I had gotten an agent, and we were playing shows, you know, five nights a week. Load in our gear. I would stop at Chabad and get food, and sometimes the Chabad would come, and we would do Minyan, and I would daven there, and we'd play a show in Cleveland or wherever, Boise or some random place. And that's how it started. And we just started playing shows like that.
Do you ever miss Yeshiva?
Did I miss Yeshiva at the time?
Yeah.
Oh, hell no. I missed I already had a family, I'm pretty sure at that point. I was already married and I had a kid. So I missed being away from my son. But then I started bringing them. Once we started making money and I could get like a tour bus or two, it was like everyone was coming with me. And then that was like a whole nother chapter of insanity of, because we had two kids back to back, so, and a dysfunctional marriage. So it was like, it was insane. Yeah, that was like a bit much. And big shows, and lots of them on different continents for several years. So,
remember any specific shows stick out from that period?
Sting, like singing Roxanne with Sting at Ramakon Stadium. And sitting in with Trey, which was the band that I dropped out of high school to follow. Oh, you had asked about the moment. So the moment was this. I was at Bonnaroo. Stubbs was out and it was doing like amazing. It was selling like thousands and thousands of copies a week, I think. And I was Bonnaroo, which just got canceled this weekend, last weekend or next weekend, last weekend. And I was spending Shabbos by Chabad, like an hour away. And Trey was headlining. Trey's the guitar player from Fish. And he was headlining Saturday night. And I got a call from my manager, Motzi Shabbos, like, come back to Bonnaroo, like, immediately. Like, I'm like, what? He's like, Trey wants to meet you. And I'm like... holy shit, it's happening.
This is the guy that you've been, basically, you crossed the country hitchhiking to see him play.
This was like, I took my first hit of acid at 16 after I got home from Israel. in Worcester, Massachusetts at the Centrum, and I watched this band like make music and like had like, you know, this total experience of on the molecular level of us all being Hashem Echad, like of us all being one. And from that moment on, I was like, I want more of that. Like, how do I get that? It's something about music. And so I'm going to focus like my energy towards music. So I was 16 then.
And then this guy, like, you know, and years I had, later, like, moments he wants
on
to meet
psychedelics
you.
Where I had one moment in particular, and you don't know where the line is of reality and what's your own, like, you know, fantasies that you're kind of like projecting and stuff. But I swear to God, like, Trey looked at me in Charleston, South Carolina, or Charlotte, I forget where. And I was like, dude, I'm going to do music with you. And he was like, yes, you are. I will see you in a few years. So I'm like, you know, never at that point would I have thought in a million years that I would become Hasidic or religious or any of that. And like all these things unfolded before that. But I'm like on my way back to Bonnaroo. I'm like, the Hasidic, we were learning Hasidus, you know, and I'm like tying the whole thing to the Hasidus and all this shit. And we're going back, and I ended up sitting in with Trey singing No Woman, No Cry. And then they also learned like Close My Eyes from my album, Live at Stubbs. Like the band learned it on the spot and then like forgot it on stage in front of 50,000 people. And then I led them by beatboxing like back into the jam. And I was like leading Trey and the band like back, like into doing my own music in front of 50,000 people. So that would probably be like the moment where I was just like, the fucking dream came true. Like, it really actually all kind of like, I did it. I gave myself over. I didn't know how it was going to happen. I let go. I did the hardest things that were the hardest things imaginable for me. And I like stayed true to it. I followed it. And now it like, it's happening now, you know?
So I think now is the best time to ask you about, you know, it's sitting there for a lot of people. What is Jewish reggae? Isn't that an oxymoron? Like, how can reggae be Jewish? And how can Jewish be reggae?
Well, you and some rabbis as well. I had an experience once in Cleveland where there was a lot of times where I would go like daven in the shuls and I was, things were blowing up. People had heard of me, like, you know, I was like a little bit famous, you know. And I would just roll up to shul, like in some random city where I had a show or whatever. And I would really want to meet the rabbi, like the. And sometimes they were like really cool, like in Detroit. I remember like going and like, there's a big community there, and I ended up somehow like at the Rav's house for breakfast, and it was just like this old woman and him, and we were just like eating breakfast together. It was like so nice. And then other times, like in Milwaukee. I want to call people out. Schmudkin. Oh, I can't help myself. Where they'll be like, every Chabad you go to, you got to pay from this point forward. Any city you go into, you're going to have to pay that Chabad and get permission. But in Cleveland, Haichen, Rabbi Haichen, Rav Haichen, you know, after the show wants to speak to me. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, this is it, man. This rabbi is going to give me the secret of how I'm going to juggle this crazy life of being a chassid. He's going to give me something real. And he pulls out a newspaper that says that I do reggae. And then he points to like, he says that the article, which was not a good article, was written about me, was a person saying that I was appropriating like the culture, Jamaican culture, whatever. And he was basically saying like, if you're speaking like them and dressing like them and doing that whole thing, it's completely like usher in the Torah. Like, you're completely banned from doing this shit. With like the article circled and like the halacha circled. Have a nice night.
So basically, like, mostly to like the haters. Journalist was like, he's appropriating, then a rabbi saying you're appropriating, yeah. And together for
and my truth, which was why I've never paid that argument any attention. Is that like actually the entire, all of it has been appropriated from the Torah. All the religions have appropriated shit from the Torah. Every play, everything you could fucking imagine, you know, has been appropriated from Jews. So it's no problem for me to take something and shift it back into a new context. Now, Rastafarianism believes that Solomon and Sheba had a baby, and that baby went back to Ethiopia, and then eventually, like, they came back with his crew to Jerusalem and stole the Ark of the Covenant and brought it back to Ethiopia. But that's where there's like some divergence. But the whole line of Judah and King David and all the symbolism and all the imagery in reggae music, which comes from Rastafarianism, is all like taken directly from Old Testament. And you go from like lyric to lyric from like all of the original reggae music down the line as like direct quotes from either Tehillim or the Old Testament. Exodus, you know, all these concepts. So for me,
Lion of Zion,
all of these things. For me, when I was introduced to Bob Marley, which we didn't even talk about, when I was 14, it was similar to that, like that energy with Karlbach, Shlomo Karlbach, when I kind of got into that. So I became immediately deeply connected to the music, right? Like so many people connect to Bob Marley's music. But for me, I just totally just like internalized it. And it really made me question, like, what are they talking about all of this Jewish stuff in here? Like, what, the only place I've ever heard any of this shit is in Hebrew school. So what's the connection? So that really sent me on a journey to like find the connection. Where's the connection? Where does it come from? And where does it separate? And all of that. But when I started doing reggae music, it's not just like doing like any random genre, like let's say Christian rock, let's say, nothing against Christian rock, but you're just taking a random genre like rock, and then you're kind of like using your ideology, you know, in that genre. Well, like Jewish ideology is deeply, deeply like rooted in reggae music. Whether it was made to be that way or not, it's there, right? So for me doing it, it always, in my feeling, and to many others, resonated as authentic. It resonates as authentic. Even if you have no understanding of reggae music or Judaism, there's something that just maybe feels right about it. And that would be kind of the thing that got a lot of people, like that first Jimmy Kimmel thing was like, people are thinking like reggae, Judaism, opposites. How stupid is that? This is going to be fucking hilarious. And then you see it and you're like, Shema Yisrael.
It makes sense. Like,
this shit is, right? So that was the experience for people at first. And that was a big part of the thing why people became really like, wow, they, you know.
You mentioned, I want to, you know, you said about Israel and the words that keep coming, and you mentioned Israel, Alexander Mas High School. You mentioned playing with Sting in Ramat Gan. What was your connection to Israel growing up, and what's your connection to Israel now? Like, what's that journey like for you?
Well, like I said, like my parents have a love for Israel. They wanted to move there. So I think that's very relevant today, because in a lot of reform situations or assimilated Jewish situations, like much of America, there is no understanding or connection to Israel. But then you've got like some people that were like Zionists, you know, even though they weren't religious, like atheist Zionists and stuff like that. So I would say like my parents were like that. Like, not that they're atheists, but God was never really like the topic. There was always like a love for Israel and like this idea of like Israel being, I could always tell with my dad that somehow like Israel was like, and I really always like respected like what my dad thought was cool. Mm-hmm. My dad rides motorcycles. My dad likes good music. He did homeless housing his entire career, cares about people. He's an incredible human being. But I would always was kind of like, I could just see like my dad just loved Israel and just, I don't know. So I always had a feel for it, you know. Then I went to Israel when I was 16, and that kind of like really blew my mind, because seeing just every Jew doing every type of Jew doing every type of thing, and just the feeling of being in Israel just was an incredible feeling. And I was just a kid. I was 16. So, you know, it's hard to calculate exactly what. It was just a great thing. It just felt amazing. And it always became a part of who I was. And especially as I started listening to reggae music and I start connecting the Star of David and the Lion of Judah and all that, I started making my mishmash of like Judaism and you know, all of that. And reggae music and music, it fit in. And then when I was like young artist, I would take Tishrei off every year basically and go to Israel with my wife and Levi and Shalom. And we would just, I would spend a month just wandering around Jerusalem, davening in different shuls and checking out different places and just being super Jewish. So that was also playing shows in Israel, you know, Tel Aviv. And I have like, you know, videos that were built about days that I had in Israel.
Were you ever afraid?
Yeah. I was afraid because I didn't grow up with that kind of thing. Like I write my mentor and my teacher, Ephraim like Rosenstein, for many years, and he was originally my therapist in Crown Heights, lived in Hebron. So he was missing all his fingers because he was, you know, all shot off by a machine gun, like at point blank range around that one turn. And I would go stay with him, and we would stay in like crazy places where there was no military, and we would, it'd be like Yom Kippur, and we'd be on the top of a fucking hill somewhere. And I'm like, fucking, oh shit. There's like four dudes with machine guns here. Like, we could just fucking, you know, but. I mean, yeah, man, I was scared in Israel many times. I was there like during the stabbing, when the stabbings was going on.
The knife intifada.
Yeah, right. I was there during, the first time I was there was when Rabin was assassinated, that when I was 16, I was there during that. So I remember like right away that there was like political, there was like all kinds of craziness that I didn't understand, you know. But I remember also feeling like at some point, like Judaism is really happening in Israel. Like in America, I mean, you've got your religious communities and then you've got like, you know, a couple of people that have like maybe organic farms or something like that. But like Judaism didn't really, like nothing really happened here with it. And Israel is really where Judaism has been like happening for a while. And you go to Israel, you feel that. You know, and if you're Jewish and you're living like a Jewish lifestyle, or you're, you know, like, if it means something to you, then it was very, very special to me. So yeah, over the years playing shows and going there and all that, and then on October 7th. So I've always viewed like Israelis as like brothers and sisters, like cousins, like family,
right.
Jews. You know, like. As much as like Jews have driven me crazy, and there's been times where I'm like, oh,
that's what family does.
Yeah.
That's what family does. You got family, relatives that drive you crazy, right?
Yeah. When it comes down to it, there's a lot of things. But one of the main thing is Israelis are family. And then the other thing is that like you see, like we're living in history, and although we live in a time of history that it hasn't been so bad for the Jews, if you just have a like little bit of sense to like step out for a second, look at the patterns of things, you know, it's like, okay, we want to believe that we're like more sophisticated and things have come and these things could never happen again. But like, we have to have a fucking place. We see it now. We have to have a place that we go to. And Israelis like go to the military when they're 18, they defend the country. They put up with all this bullshit, you know, because it's like when I wasn't religious, I would, just knowing that these dudes at Toldos Aron were like davening the same way, even if I wasn't there, it just felt good. Like, all right, cool. Someone's holding that down.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't want to lose that. I wouldn't want that to go away if my leaving really meant that it was not going to happen. But someone's holding that down. Someone's holding down Israel. And meanwhile, Americans, like, we're over here, you know, I don't know. So, but for me, definitely. And I know a long part of my journey and like my life was really dedicated and like focused heavily in Judaism. And then coming out the other side, I was like, okay, I need a break. I need to, you know, just relax and just be a human being and watch the football game and like have a barbecue, smoke weed again, you know, and like.
So when do you lose the.
But then after October 7th, all of a sudden it switches. It's like, I got to take myself and things a little more seriously and step up, and because it's a serious situation, And because we have to step forward, like we, it's our time. Like we have to shine. We have to. It's like, it's the same. I see it. It's an important time for us. So,
so what'd you do? What was your reaction to your personal reaction to October 7?
Well, immediately I was playing a show that morning, on Saturday, and Reggae Festival in Las Vegas. I tried to reach out to another Jew that I knew was also headlining, performing at the festival. Doesn't really represent himself as a Jew, but I know he's a Jew. And I asked if I wanted to record like a version of Jerusalem or something together to do something. And for the first time ever, like I can't, he won't return my calls. He doesn't want to talk to me. Until finally someone tells me like he does not want to do anything Jewish or connected to Israel.
This was
was right when this happened, yeah.
Do you have an idea why?
Yeah, I know exactly why. Like you're either this way or that way. You're one way or the other. It's the way we're built, I think, you know? There are scared Jews that will like want to run at the first drop of like anything. And then there are like Jews that really feel the opposite. Like the opposition just burns a fire.
What was this guy scared of?
He doesn't want anybody knowing like that. I don't even know what his politics are. He might not have a love for Israel, to say the least. Who knows? I'm not going to make like any kind of things, but like I kind of feel like if after October 7th, something doesn't shake you inside that makes you be like, I'm Jewish, then I get on stage, I see someone with an Israeli flag, I immediately pull them up on stage, I grab the flag, I say the Shema, and I know in that moment, oh shit, like, okay, here we go again. Like, you're stepping back into being like really Jewish, being like in touch and connected, like to God in a Jewish way, to the God of Israel. And that's what this is about now. Like, nothing else really matters. And it's not about religion, like at all. That's why I say there's like a paradigm shift. I really don't think it's about religion at all anymore. It's like bigger than that.
What is it about?
Mashiach. It's bigger than that.
What are your views of people like Macklemore jumping on the bandwagon, using the music to push their hatred?
Horrible. Just horrible. It's so horrible.
What's their story? How does someone like Macklemore and others like him, like how do they get to that point?
I don't know. They're either anti-Semitic to begin with and they see like a hole. They're like, I'm going to run with this because I hate Jews to begin with. Maybe they had a bad Jewish lawyer that fucked them out of a deal or a record deal. Who fucking knows? I don't know why people are anti-Semitic, but I'm sure it has, some of it may have to do with experiences they've had. I don't know. I assume in the music industry, because there's so many Jews running things in the music industry, you know, which is what it is. But, you know, I don't know, man. I just think either that or they're just totally like morons. They're just like misinformed morons that are quick to jump at something in order to gain attention from it, you know? So like, I don't know which one it is, but either way, I try not to like think about it too much. I know it sucks. I mean, it literally results in Jews dying, so...
So how come we're not seeing, you know, 90s hip-hop had East Coast, West Coast feuds? How come we're not seeing more, you know, anti-Semites versus Jews and reggae hip-hop?
You don't have that many Jews that represent themselves, like, as Jews in the music world.
So right? You got any advice for young Jewish musicians working their way up now? Not about how to make it, because that's...
Yeah.
Different, but how to stand up for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I have two sons that are into music and they're both, so I give them advice all the time on stuff. And like one of my sons got into Berkeley and he was going to go to Berkeley this fall, but he's deferring so he can go to yeshiva in Israel. He's in Israel right now. Dove Bear, his music is incredible. Check him out. His music is awesome. That's the younger one. He's 18. And then his older brother, Levi, also makes incredible music. Actually, they're starting a project together called Brothers of Redemption, I think is what it's called. Brothers of Redemption.
Good name.
Yeah, I was messing with them this morning. I was like, I think it should be Maccabee Youth, but they were laughing at me. We did a song together. Actually, they did a song with these guys, an incredible song, and I sang on it just a little bit. So I was all hyped. I was listening to the mix this morning, and I was thinking about them. And, you know, like, you know, for my son, I was like, you know, tapping into your identity, like developing yourself as an artist and developing your skill. But then there's if you're a songwriter, there's developing like the content, like what are you going to write about? Like you're going to write about the experiences of your life and what you're like learning. So, you know, I think that's important. Like to him, I didn't fight that. Like, you know, you would think, oh, you're a musician. Your kid got into, he's going to go to Berkeley. Like you want him to go, you know? And I was like, nah, it's totally cool. Like stay in yeshiva and like have experiences, you know, feel what it feels like to be in Israel right now. I'm like, you guys are there. Like you're in the middle of it all. Like you're going to look back in time and be like, I was there, you know? So, I mean, I think that's informing him. Like he left for yeshiva with long hair, looking like this grungy kind of kid. And then he threw a festival at his yeshiva, a music festival at his yeshiva with himself as the headliner. And he shaved off his hair in the middle of like the show and kept his payas. He's rocking the payas right now. Just kind of hilarious. Just kind of awesome too. I mean, so yeah, I think like, you know, I would just advise people to like go on the journey of like self-discovery and self-knowledge, like, and try to like just get deeper and deeper into like yourself and into your art.
Like, you got to know who you are if you want to stand up for us.
Yeah. And I feel like if you become obsessed with it, you kind of become obsessed with the art. You kind of become obsessed with the expression and like the identity and all of that as an artist. That's kind of not for everyone. Not I'm not talking about every art form or musicians or, but for someone who's like in that realm. Yeah.
And you have a new album coming out?
Yeah, I have a new album called The Ancient Child, and that is coming out October 3rd, I believe it is, or 5th. It's like the day after Yom Kippur, and I'm releasing first single from that on June 28th. It's called Rockin' Tempos, and the singles will be out all summer.
Who or what is The Ancient Child?
The Ancient Child, well, I don't really want to expose it all, but basically it's an idea of Mashiach. It says that basically like their spirit of Mashiach is like born at the beginning. It's like as ancient as the beginning of time. It was like whispered into the world at the beginning of creation, hovering over the waters. And yet it's like unborn, you know, or just born. So it's like this ancient child, this dichotomy, life, death, how it all fits together, comes together, plays off each other.
All right. Ancient Child coming out October 2025.
Yes.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Well, we're going to end every episode as we do with the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just I trust that whatever comes to mind will come out of your mouth. And I love that.
Yeah.
So, Matisyahu, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Shit. What don't people know about me? It's supposed to be like the first thing that comes to your head, but so many things have come to my head that I don't want to reveal, actually.
Let's keep it that way.
all right. Some people know this, but I have a border collie, and I love playing frisbee with my dog.
I love that.
Many times a day. Yeah.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Oh, man. I'm actually horrible at lightning questions.
Okay.
You may think I'm really good at it because like, oh, he loves to talk and shit. But I'm so slow like with my thoughts and stuff when it comes to
talking.
Take
your time, buddy.
I'm really horrible at it. It's not the first time I've had to do it. Trust me. The lightning round. What is the one thing people don't know about Jews? That we're the originators of reggae music. Well, that's not true. We're not the originators of reggae music, but that we inspired a big part of reggae music.
What is your favorite curse?
Oh, just thinking of this one curse word that my kid says, my three-year-old's been saying lately. It's this combination of curse words. I can't repeat it. I don't know. I like saying the F bomb. I've been known to drop the F bomb many times. I'm trying to work on that now. I've watched videos of myself cursing, like, because I'm either been drinking too much or I'm angry about something, or I think it's funny, and it's so repulsive to me. I'm like, it's so grotesque. I'm like, oh, what you were saying was so awesome, and you just like littered it by cursing through the whole time. So, but yeah, I've been known to curse, but then your kids start cursing. When you're like little kids start cursing in the same exact tone, using the same words that you use. So I've actually been working on not cursing so much.
When was the last time you cried?
I cry in movies a lot.
I don't know if it's because
I'm so emotionally constipated, like normally, that like I'll see like the smallest, stupidest thing in a movie and I'm like tears crying, trying to hide them back. My wife makes fun of me, like really makes fun of me.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Like my first thought is like King David, but I don't know. King David, maybe.
Yeah, you can.
Probably conversation with Solomon might be better. He was known for his wisdom.
And they were both writers.
Yeah. Right? But who do you want to hang with, right? Like, I want to hang with, like, comedians, like, more than musicians.
You'd probably want to hang with the prophets.
In this order, athlete, actor, musician, comedian. Who do you want to hang out with?
Comedian.
Musician, like, that's going to be, like, the way athlete. Cooler hang. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A musician before actor? Yeah.
For sure. But I'm probably
I'm more starstruck by actors than musicians.
Because you're a musician.
That's why, I guess.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Well, Hanukkah, Matas Yahu. But yeah. Pesach, I like Pesach. I love matzah. I've realized, especially like when I became less religious and I didn't have matzah for a minute, and then I had matzah again, like I fucking love matzah so much. I love it, and I only eat it how I ate it in Chabad, like just Shmorah matzah with a little salt on it. Can't dip it in anything. You can't smear anything on it.
Not the tasty matzah, nothing.
No, not the egg matzah, not the box matzah. Like just shmorah matzah with a little salt on it. I could eat that all day. I swear, that'd be like the best snack in the world. I would take, if I could only have one snack, it would be shmorah matzah with salt.
What was your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur is tough when you're like really religious, like all day long.
When do you feel safest?
Probably like with my wife, probably.
When do you feel least safe?
When I've taken too much LSD. Too much psychedelics can make me feel unsafe, I guess.
What gives you hope?
The Jewish people, the Israelis, actually, specifically. I'm Yisrael Chai, the nation of Israel. The Jews, too. The Jews also, like, really, I really feel we're really a force to be reckoned with. We are some badass motherfuckers. I really believe that.
Ancient children.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Where should they donate to? Oh, man. I don't really know. The spots, you know, like the specific spots, but donate to Israel. Donate to the people of Israel in some way, what they're going through. Whether it's, you know, families of the hostages, whether it's to the IDF, whether it's to people that are, I guess right now, find those people that have been affected by the most recent missiles that have been fired from Iran. I'm sure there's lots of funds, but I would find one of those funds and donate there, you know? These people are going to have to figure out where they're going to live and all that. There's a lot of people that are going to be misplaced now.
Matisyahu, where can people find you and your music? It's everywhere.
Well, thanks to a traffic cop in Muncie who owns modestyahoo.com, you can find me at modestyahooworld.com.
Matisyahuworld.com, and you're on Instagram,
yeah,
Twitter, TikTok,
yep,
Pinterest.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I just look at cool stuff on Pinterest, like redone tour buses and stuff like that.
Love it. Well, this has been a pleasure, and I'm just glad that you're here. So here I am with Matisyahu.
Yeah, and thank you for everything you do. Thanks, man. You've been, I've been watching, following you since everything, Colombia and everything that went down. I was watching all that. And thank you for standing up for the Jews and for just being, your fire is very obvious, and we see it, we feel it. So keep going strong. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."